This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Welcome to the podcast that is all about the sex, slave, and shit. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and if I could, I would have voted for Obama for a third term.
Hey, this is Chris, and all I know is sometimes when there's too many white people, I get nervous, you know?
Boy, are you on the wrong podcast?
Yeah.
In this episode, we're discussing Get Out, starring Daniel Kaluuya, Allison Williams, Catherine Keener, Bradley Whitford, and directed by Jordan Peele. Gentlemen, this is possibly one of the biggest movies of 2017. This is one of those that came out in February and it was talked about long into December. So I have to ask, how did you become aware of this movie, and did you see it prior to watching it for this podcast? And I want to start with you, Ken.
I'm not sure where I first heard about it. It's almost like with all the craziness going on this year, it just kind of infiltrated I'm completely mispronouncing the word. Just kind of infiltrated 2017 as a whole, and you just kind of felt like it's always been there. And I wanted to watch it all year, but I didn't get a chance to. It was out on DVD. And luckily, the library had a copy free this weekend. So I grabbed it, watched it.
Nice.
And here we are.
So. What about you, Chris?
I went to the theatrical screening the week of release. And it was really interesting, like, just seeing in a theater with a packed audience just because... so many different reactions from people and stuff. But yeah, I saw it then and I saw it again now. So, I mean, I don't want to give away how I felt about it. So, you know.
Okay. Well, what did you feel about it at that time? Because it might change from this.
It was really fun in the theater, I thought. Just because, like, feeling... I like movies in the theater where you can, like, feel that kind of different kind of reaction from people. So, I mean, that was really cool to me.
All right, so I guess I should preface this by saying that I am a huge Key and Peele fan. Do either of you watch Key and Peele, or did y'all watch Key and Peele while it was on the air?
From time to time.
Of course, okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. And of course, we know the famous White House Correspondence Anger Translation, but that wasn't Peele. That was Key, wasn't it?
That is true.
But, yeah.
And Luther was my end to Key and Peele as well. But the thing is that... I got on that train pretty early on, and I stuck it out through to the end. And I actually enjoyed Keanu, even though it wasn't what I call a great movie. But the thing was is that I had heard rumblings about the post-Key and Peele schedule and what would be seen from both Keegan-Michael Key, who went on to do a lot of both indie and mainstream movies. But Jordan Peele, on the other hand... he really kind of kept quiet. You know, outside of doing a couple of voice acting things, he really just kind of kept to himself. But we've been hearing that he had his eye on directing, and he wanted to direct a horror film. And, I mean, as someone who enjoys the Key and Peele sketch comedy, I just wasn't really sure what I would think about in regards to a Jordan Peele horror movie. But I also knew that he was a talented guy. He could do all the different stuff. And there's actual segments of Key and Peele that dealt with horror comedy. You know, there were zombie episodes. There were other kind of monster episodes. But a straight-up horror movie, well, that would be interesting. I mean, we saw other directors do it before. I mean, American Werewolf in Paris was... or, sorry, American Werewolf in London. Sorry, okay. No, don't watch the other Paris. But yeah. American Werewolf in London was directed by John fucking Landis, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
And so it is possible for a comedy director to do a straight-up horror movie. So when I saw the first trailer for Get Out, I was kind of on the fence a little bit. I was kind of curious to see what he would do with this material, especially with a title like Get Out. I was kind of curious as to if he was going to actually make this a straight-up horror movie or if this was going to be a horror comedy. And when I went and saw it, I will admit, I wasn't amused. I wasn't a fan of the movie. Well, let's put it this way. There were a lot of problems, and we'll talk about those problems when we get into this to this discussion. But one of the things that surprised me was how many critics just adored this movie. It wasn't that it was just it was liked. It was like being considered one of the great movies of 2017 back in February. And I found myself really questioning why the critics had this kind of love for it. And then, of course, one of the detractors for this film is Armand White. And I'll be honest here, I don't like agreeing with Armand White even for lunch. Yeah. So I don't like being in that position of being on the same side as Armand White. But I guess that's why we're here. We're here to discuss this movie. We're here to discuss where this movie goes right, where this movie goes wrong. And I will go right off the bat and say there's a lot on both sides that I believe about this movie. So I guess let's start off with the premise around this movie. The film itself really tackles a pretty sensitive issue, which is racial relations between African Americans and white people specifically. And it's dealing with it from a perspective of a young man of color who's going into a predominantly white neighborhood, a white liberal neighborhood, not a racist neighborhood, yeah. or what we stereotypically consider racist neighborhoods, right? This is a place that wants to consider itself very progressive, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's dealing with that kind of race relations, but it's also dealing perhaps with hypocrisy a little bit. Is that kind of what you're getting from this movie?
Well, I wasn't sure if they were being hypocrites or if everything was just an act anyway.
I mean, without giving away the major spoilers right off the bat, I mean, they do kind of use these people of color for purposes.
And there is some racist stuff going. It's like, oh, we know you're physically better. It's like, wait, how do you know what?
Bring it right off the bat. I mean, okay.
Yeah.
I guess, Chris, do you kind of see those things being discussed, or do you think that there are other elements that are being brought up in the film?
I think that's pretty much it. I don't disagree. I mean, I feel like those are the major issues, so, I mean, I agree.
Do you see any other issues that are being brought up?
Not offhand. No, not while I was watching it this time, I don't think.
Out of curiosity, Chris, specifically, mm-hmm. when you're saying not this time, what kind of were the differences that you saw between this screening and the prior screening? Or did you have any? Did it just reaffirm what you saw in the first time?
The one major thing is, like, and I mean, it affects all horror movies like this, is, like, once you know everything, it kind of changes the way you look at it anyway. So, like, the surprise factor's gone. And, I mean, once that's gone, it's still good, but it'll never be as good as that first time. To me, anyway. So, I mean, that was the only major thing I noticed watching from the first time, you know, 10 months ago and now. So,
true.
All right, let's bring up the way that this film starts us off. It starts us off with a young man in a really nice neighborhood. It doesn't outright say that it's a white neighborhood, but it's definitely a neighborhood that that feels very non of color, so say.
Yeah.
And we see this guy who is feeling very uncomfortable here. He's apparently trying to meet someone and is abducted. Does this set up the suspense of the film right off the bat? Did it set up the film properly to you?
I was a bit lost. I was like, why is he there anyway? But he's meeting someone, yeah, but Then it goes straight into the next scene. It's like, what does that have to relate to? And then we find out later how it all relates. But mm-hmm. it was a little off for me. But
I will say that watching it the first time, I thought it was an interesting premise. But I'll say the second time around, knowing what I know about what's happening, this kind of falls apart. But we can talk about it when we talk about later okay. into the film. But what about you, Chris? So what did you? How did this opener set the movie up for you? Did it set the right tone? Did it create an atmosphere? Or did it provide you with the context about what was going to happen later on in the film?
I mean, looking at it that way, I mean, I guess it doesn't really relate to a girl bringing, you know, guys of different color home to, you know, hypnotize and take over with their dead family members or whatever. But at the time, and I mean, even at this time when I watched it, it grabs your attention. And that's typically what an opening scene is supposed to do. So, I mean, I didn't really see a problem with it until you brought it up. And then it's like, oh, yeah, I guess so. That's kind of doesn't really relate to it. So, but I mean, it doesn't bother me. It didn't bother me beforehand. So,
okay. Well, I will say, you know, since you did kind of bring up what the rest of the film is going to do.
Yeah.
Sorry.
The problem with this opening, the second time around, the first time around, you'll give it a pass primarily because you don't really know exactly what's going to happen next. Like, are we going to follow this guy? Or are we going to go with someone else? I mean, you've seen if you see the trailer, then you kind of know that that's not the person we're going to be following. But on the first screening, this opening definitely kind of gives you a vibe of someone is taking black men, yeah. right?
Right.
Especially since the next scene, we're going to be introduced to Chris, who is our main protagonist, and what we do is we see him showering, right? That insinuates nakedness. That this movie has kind of, I don't want to say it fetishizes, but it definitely makes it very clear that skin is important in this movie. Skin is talked about very frequently. Skin is made very apparent in a lot of scenes. There is kind of an insinuation, even not just of black and white, but of various shades as well, yeah. as we'll get into a little bit later. But the problem here is that at no point does this opening give any indication as to things that are going to happen later. There's no foreshadowing. There's no callbacks to this yeah. outside of that a particular character, you know, this character shows up a bit differently and we're made to believe, you know, that something has happened to him. But the thing is that what happens to Chris is not what happens to this guy, or it doesn't even happen the same way as this guy does. Right. And so that's a big problem. That I have with this opening on like the second and third screenings, but you know, especially considering that this is a horror film and this is a Blumhouse film. Let's go ahead and I have to bring up probably the biggest name mm-hmm. in this movie is the one that very few people even know, and that's Jason Blum, who is the producer of this particular yes. film and practically reinvented horror films for almost the last 10 years. Out of curiosity, Kent, have you ever heard of the name Jason Blum?
It sounds familiar, and I'm not sure if it's because you've mentioned it or it's because of its two kind of common name. Oh wait, okay. Looking up his IMDb, yeah, Paranormal Activity. Yeah, okay. So I know who. Okay, I'm getting that.
Just naming Paranormal Activity is the yeah. tip of the iceberg when it comes yeah. to Jason
and
Blum.
And Whiplash.
Yes.
Not horror, but.
Well, Whiplash is a bit different. Is a bit different in right. regards to Jason Blum, but that's not how Jason Blum made his money,
right.
and why he is basically the powerhouse name in horror that he is right now. But Chris, you obviously must know Jason Blum and Jason Blum's formula.
Insidious.
Yeah, I do, but I didn't look up his stuff to prepare myself. But I mean, I know I've seen his stuff.
Are you familiar
with
the $5 million babies?
No.
All right, so Jason Blum has a formula that he allows, and this is actually one of the most brilliant formulas in Hollywood. He will provide filmmakers with $5 million, basically to make the film that they're going to make with very little interference from him or other people. They go out, they make a $5 million movie, and mostly they're in the horror realms, which usually can go for about, you know, on an opening, anywhere between 15 to 20 million right off the bat. So he makes a profit pretty much on first week. And if they're big enough, then he'll make sequels, which will double and triple that. And so what he'll do is he'll take chances on little-known filmmakers and on film premises that may or may not, get attention from other film studios. And he did Insidious, he did Paranormal Activity, he's had his hand in pretty much every major horror franchise from that period on. And he's made an empire. In fact, he is the guy that you should be thanking for the resurgence of M. Night Shyamalan, because he did The Visit for $5 million. He's taken on very risky projects. And they paid off in dividends. Like I said, I mean, just look at the Paranormal Activity films. They were made for very little, and they just grossed out the wazoo on itself. And in a way, I wish that more studios would take the Jason Blum model and do that instead of making $200, $300, $500 million movies and then hoping that international sales will carried into the $1 billion to the $1 billion ranges that they want. But again, that's just me. But anyway, bringing it back to Get Out, Jason Blum obviously gave Jordan Peele, who is a comedian by trade, and took a chance on him with a horror film.
Well, he's very creative, though. I mean, you could tell he's just from his comedy show that there was a lot of creative ideas there. So he approached it and said, I have this creative idea for horror. It's like, well, tell me what it is. Like, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Here's the money. Go do it. So,
yeah. Well, no, don't get wrong. It's not like Jason Blum just goes, hey, bum, you want $5 million to make a movie? No, you have to have something that he can get behind and something he can market. I mean, that's really important, is he has to be able to market this. He has to be able to make sure he gets a return on investment. And in order to do that, it has to be something that, even if it's a bad idea, it has to be something that he can market and at least get $15 million out of in order to recoup costs. And horror is a very easy market to recoup the costs. Yeah. And, you know, as we've seen with a lot of these franchises, you know, they come back and make even more money if they hit it right. But anyway, so coming back to Get Out and setting it, you have to have this initial scare, this initial suspense moment in order to get people invested. And so now that we have this out of the way, the rest of the horror that we're going to be getting from here on up until, I want to say, about the last act of the film, it's a three-act structure. Up until the last act, it's all building, right? It's building suspense from moment to moment. And it's all about the discomfort that Chris feels and the growing discomfort that he feels as he is moving forward through this story. He starts off uncomfortable because, as we hear from him talking to Rose, his girlfriend, he's nervous about going to meet her parents because of his skin color, because he isn't sure as to what to expect. And
the standard going to meet your girlfriend's parents on top of that.
Well, yeah.
I mean, come on.
But. And she's constantly giving him giving encouragement to take this chance, right? This, you know, this is, I guess, I want to probably make a reference to Guess Who's Coming to Dinner a bit.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of a girl bringing her black boyfriend home and having things get uncomfortable, maybe even words being said that probably shouldn't be said, things of that nature. And he's really worried about that. And as we have the road trip up there, we have, you know, him talking to his friend, the amazing Rod.
Yeah.
I love Rod. Okay, I'm just going to go ahead and say it right now. Rod is my favorite character in this fucking movie. Let's be honest here. He's the geek. He's the geek that knows all the shit. He knows what's going down. He knows everything. In fact, he practically tells you everything that's going to happen before it happens. Right? I mean, he's wrong about the sex slaves and shit, but outside of that, he knows what he's talking about.
He can't even imagine what's really going on. He'd be like, what? He'd probably have the same reaction the detectives do to him. It's like, are you sure about that?
And Rod's the comedy in this movie, right? He's the guy that lays down some truths. He's the guy who is capable of kind of calling a spade right here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be honest here. Every time they bring it back to Rod, even when it completely negates from the script, and we'll talk about the police scene in a little bit, has absolutely nothing to do with the movie, but yeah. I welcome it because it gives me more time with Rod. Come on, you have to admit. I mean, every time that it's like he just steals the scenes that he's in. In fact, I would have mind if they did a little bit of the Shining thing and just followed him a little bit more as he's going back, you know, going up to get his friend. You know, maybe here have some more of him ranting and raving about all the things that are happening, making more references. His Jeffrey Dahmer rant is to die for, right? The Jeffrey Dahmer stuff is just I bust out of laughing when he was talking about how no one suspected Jeffrey Dahmer of nothing until they were sucking their head, the brains out of their heads. I mean, it's just that's what this character does, and it's so awesome to have a character that can do that and make this, you know, make his scenes work as well as he does, right? And if you disagree with me, we're going to have words.
No, well, his stuff
Chris,
works.
I noticed so. You're very silent over there.
No, Rod's great. Rod? Rod's, you know, he's the comedic relief. So, you know, he's pretty great.
are you telling me that we shouldn't have more Rod? Huh? Did you want just a straight up horror movie?
No, God, no.
All right. But we also have the deer scene. Now, this in a horror film is basically the sign of what we call the harbinger, right? That something bad's going to happen. Usually, it's a character, you know, your crazy Fred, you know, saying you're all going to die, kind of thing. But this is that moment, right? This is the moment where this is an omen of that something really bad's about to happen. Do you kind of get that?
Well, I was hoping they'd call back to that cop in some way, but they don't. So it's kind of a MacGuffin thing going on.
Yes, I'm going to agree a bit. I also don't think that you need to have the cop anymore. This is just setting up that Chris might be right in kind of going into a white neighborhood in a white environment and being outside of that and kind of letting the audience understand where Chris is where Chris feels in this environment. One of the gray areas that I have about this film is in whether or not most of the issues that Chris is having is within himself, or if it's actually the environment that he's around. That if the threat isn't his own self-consciousness about being in a white neighborhood, or if it's that the white neighborhood is actually out to get him. And I will be honest here, I would think it would have been a bit stronger if a lot more of this was inside his own head. That perhaps he's making things worse for himself simply because he has his own biases that he is having to struggle with. I don't know. But at the same time, though, Jordan Peele is trying to say something that isn't, that is more kind of trying to deal with something societal. And I don't know if it's as strong as he wants it to be or if he's making the point that he's intending. And that's one of my problems with that particular message. But as we meet the family And as we kind of see that initial discomfort, right, it's one that isn't overtly said. There's not one person going, you know, I don't feel comfortable about this. But it's in the word usage and the way that characters act, specifically Bradley Whitford. Bradley Whitford is playing... Oh, God. I don't know exactly what it is that Bradley Whitford's going for with this. Do you kind of get an idea what he's trying to do?
He's trying to do Nervous Dad or acting like Nervous Dad without giving away what he really is.
Okay.
Evil. Oh.
This is where first time and
future,
after first
right.
time things kind of get a little messy.
Right.
Because if you go from it from the first time as a dad who is nervous about his daughter's black boyfriend coming to visit and wanting to appear, to at least appear open.
Right.
And to be progressive, so to say, and failing miserably. That's one thing. The question is that this, on the second and third reviewings, though, you know that this is something that he's done multiple times before.
Yeah.
In fact, I would say that from what the pictures state, he's at least done it 8 times.
Something like that.
By this point, it's a routine performance.
Right. Which I think that is the performance. He's going for this character that's trying to be cool dad and failing. And that's the performance he wants to put out because it's so believable. Because
is it?
Chris kind of gets it. I think Chris is kind of fooled by it. It's everything else that's causing him to go, wait, what's that? Wait, who's this? Why are the only black people around here servants? Why do they act so weird?
that's technically not weird, but, I mean, it does play the stereotype, definitely. But, Chris, I'll give Chris a chance to respond before I get into another one of my problems.
Do I think what do you want me to comment on?
Okay, so Bradley Whitford's character is playing a role of kind of a progressive dad that's trying to appear more accepting of his daughter's new boyfriend than he really does. But this is a performance that he's made at least 8 times, according to the pictures.
Right.
Is that what he's really going for? Or what exactly is this character trying to do?
I mean, I feel like
What is the performance that he's trying to give?
I feel like he's purposely, like, trying to be the bumbling, like, you know, stumbling over, trying to be cool and, you know, all that kind of shit. And, I mean, are you asking if he's trying to go for something else here, or?
Well, I'm just because one of my biggest problems when it comes to Get Out is the fact that the film itself is trying to sell us on the fact trying to sell us on Chris's situation that and how they're going to quote unquote capture him. Right, they want to brainwash him, or not brainwash him, but to psychologically mold him and turn him into a vessel of sorts. And the way that they're doing that is through a psychological manipulation. The way that the film sets it up is that they want to have him psychologically susceptible, but they're doing so through making him extremely nervous. Right? Because there's at no point that he feels comfortable at all. Every moment that he comes across. And the thing is that if you are nervous and if you're constantly on edge, that, from what I understand, makes you more resilient to psychological manipulation than if you are in a comfortable situation. Right? Or do they address this at all?
Well, it's all weird pseudoscience anyway with what they need him to be a vessel. So I guess they could write in however it works, so.
Yeah. Well, the thing is they don't really explain exactly how it is that they intend to psychologically manipulate him. But the thing is, though, is that it's building on this premise because they set up the groundworks that Bradley Whitford, I'm just calling Bradley Whitford because I don't really know the character's name. I don't care. It's Bradley Whitford, West Wing, say what you will. Just be glad I don't call him Josh Lyman for the rest of the episode.
Ooh, could I call him Josh Lyman?
Oh, right, you have dibs on that.
Lemon, but, remember Lemon Lyman.
Anyway, so you have Bradley Whitford, who is kind of playing this hipster dad who would vote for Obama 3 times if he could, greatest president since he was alive. Then you have Catherine Keener's character, who seems to be the matriarch of this family. She seems to be more in control of this family. She's the power behind the throne, right?
Well, if she,
because she, I mean, she doesn't, she barely says anything. Everything that she says feels very precise and targeted.
Yeah.
Every question that she asks is leading towards and means. You know, every gesture, movement, even the way that she stirs her tea is meant to manipulate, right?
In some ways, it almost feels like some weird ritual going on. This is my role, and this is how I do it, and this person's role is this, and that's how they do it. And it's all formulaic that her stirring the tea has a particular effect on people.
Well, I mean, that's the whole thing, is that the sound itself is meant to trigger certain things to happen. I mean, when it comes to hypnotization, sounds and certain movements will definitely do it. Very subtle ones, especially if it's applied over and over and over again. The thing is, though, is that it's very clear that she's the one that's really going to do the most damage of the family. She's the one that you have to be careful of, because of the fact that she doesn't say much, and everything that she does seems to be very thought out, right? Then when we meet the brother, who... Exactly what is his role again?
I don't...
Headlock.
I mean, I take it...
Basically medical intern.
He was the one who kidnapped the first guy. He was the
one he helped with that. He's additional muscle. Literally for the brain, for the preparing things, he doesn't do much. Except for maybe, makes somebody at outies because he keeps threatening to put him in the headlock, but he's basically muscle and a medical assistant.
Heavy lifting. Yeah. That's pretty much all he's there for. So, yeah.
I always took him as the redneck. And especially with that stupid mustache, I wanted to punch him in my face myself. I mean, if there was one thing I really wish that could have happened, was that they would have either ripped that mustache off his mouth, or perhaps the mouth right off the face. I would have been okay with that, too.
Or the whole face off the... Yeah.
And that would be a whole different movie, but I would have been very appreciative of that. Because, let's be honest here, that fucking mustache is the... Oh, God, that was the worst. That is the most... redneckiest redneck thing I've ever seen in my life, and the idea of someone in the North taking that is
no. Ooh. I've seen that. I have seen that. So
I know there are people all over the country and all over the world who have that stupid ass mustache. It is the just. I hate that. I hate that thing. I hate it. But I will say, though, that. Especially when we meet Walter and Georgina, the two people who are made to... We're supposed to believe that they are the help, right?
Yeah.
Walter is the guy out in the field. Georgina is the house lady. Definitely calling back to slavery, especially when we're talking about like things like 12 Years a Slave. I kind of got that element to it. Of course, the problem with that is... especially when we know what they really are...
It does seem, when it's what they really are, it does seem a little bit like, what? Unless this is their badly chosen roles. Hey, let's be servants and just draw them in. Like, okay. That's not quite a good look. Maybe be friends down the road who are over. That would work best. I don't know.
Well, they couldn't really do that because it's, okay, let's just go ahead and let's just get into this. Okay,
yeah.
So as we find out later, the process of putting white people's brains into black people is something that's been done before, and apparently it's been done before 8 times, even though we've only seen three examples. All right, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But so as it turns out, the people who initially started this process were I don't know if it was either Bradley Whitford or Catherine Keener's mom and dad, but it's one of their moms and dads that did this. And when they did this, apparently this became a family thing where they would put more white people brains into black people. So the thing is here is that, so Walter and Georgina is the mother, is the grandpa and grandma of the group, which in certain scenes definitely work. The problem here, and this is where I'm going to probably become the biggest hypocrite ever. There is something kind of brilliant about this, but in a way that I think only Jordan Peele can truly appreciate, which is that he's basically talking about the hypocrisy of liberals by saying that only liberals white liberals,
yeah,
would see that the best way to hide their own racism is by stereotyping racism. This is something that is seen a lot, especially in people who virtue signal. That, you know, if they you know, they come out and overtly talk about being one thing, that they believe that everyone else that is just like them are this one thing, right? So if you're a progressive, you know, how do I put this? It's basically trying to establish a mistrust of people who say that they're on your side, even when they're not, because they covertly are wanting to be as bad as the other people. And this is, I don't know. Do y'all kind of get what I'm saying, or am I completely missing the mark?
Sort of. I think the hypocrisy of it is what you're saying. I think. Yeah.
Well, the whole thing is that this is hypocritical. That they firmly believe that they're progressive, right? Or they're given when they have Chris in their grasp, they're not talking about him being an N-word. They're not using bad language.
Right.
In fact, there's a reverence for African Americans that we definitely get, but they at the same time, they're still using them as tools. They're still using African Americans as vessels for their own deeds.
Well,
at the same time, though, it is quite interesting how Jordan Peele seems to think that racists want to become black people.
What? They're...
Because he's still giving the impression that these people are racists, that they believe that black people are that they can be used as tools, but yet at the same time they want to take on the persona of black people.
Well, I was trying to figure out why, but I think when Rod goes to the police, that kind of proves why. Because he's got evidence right there going, hey, this is a missing person, follow up on it, and they laugh at him. If that had been a white guy, the cops probably would have been, oh my god, what took into it? But they're like, oh, no, this guy got an older trophy white woman. It's okay. Like, no, look into this!
Look at it from the police perspective.
Yeah,
he went missing, but he's somewhere. He doesn't seem to be against his will. He's there with an older white woman. Maybe he just ran off. There's absolutely no crime here.
If there's a police, if there was a police report about him being missing, they need to follow up and just go. Even if they just show up to go, hey, dude, you okay? Yeah, cool. Okay, report closed.
I have major problems with a Google search.
Yeah,
Because let's put it this way: there are hundreds of thousands of people that go missing every year.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands. And not all of them get Google searches.
Yeah.
In fact, most just disappear off the face of the planet. Now, from what I understand of the plan is that they are going after African Americans who have very few, if any, connections to the outside world so that there's no questions.
Right.
Right? So either A, this guy had way more friends than they initially thought, and they kidnapped him and basically set the world to be looking for him, or they how do I put it? That Google search should have never existed.
Or it was an early attempt and they hadn't perfected their...
Only 6 months. Remember, yeah. There have been 8 people right. that have been kidnapped. This was done 6 months ago, as we were told by Rod. Rod said
that's
that
true.
They went missing
so this was probably
ago.
The last time it happened. What? Unless... No, because... Well, actually...
Hold on. Because we have to believe that
I'm working on a timeline here.
That Rose had been going out with Chris
4 months
for a while.
4 months, they quote. And okay, she picks up immediately after when her assignment, quote unquote, is done. She picks up right away and starts a new one. So I'm thinking for some reason the kidnapping was outside of that routine. And actually it was she was, because it wasn't the last picture he looks at with Georgina.
Yeah.
That's the last picture, but that's the question,
is
exactly
is that in
what order did they go?
Because that could have been 4.5 months ago, and then for some reason, and that lasted 4 months to get her to that position.
Well, there's indications to believe that Georgina and Walter were probably one of the first to go. In fact, what it sounds like, Walter was the first.
The very first.
Because
okay.
that was the one that she seemed to be the most bonded to. You know, especially after, you know, when Chris says that Walter has a thing for you. And she kind of twitched. That's the only person that she does that twitch for. So it makes me believe that she felt stronger towards him than others, which meant that he was probably her first. I'm going off of the Hannibal Lecter rules when it comes
okay.
to this. Well, no. Hannibal Lecter, you know, the what he gave Clarice Starling in Sons of Lambs was that the one that was the most destructive is the most brutal because they're the first.
Mm.
You know, because they had the most emotion towards that one.
Well, that's also
so,
her grandfather, though, in there now. So that could also
she's
be
she's talking
twitch.
About he has a thing for you. She's not thinking of grandfather. She's thinking of the skin.
Yeah.
Remember, skin is very important. In fact, if you notice... Rose doesn't ever say why she loves Chris outside of the fact that he's black.
Hmm.
Have you noticed they didn't show? They didn't share any common bonds.
Yeah.
Nothing that they had in common.
The only thing that makes me think he would not be the first one would be if the grandpa came up with this procedure, he would have had to have tested it once or twice just to make sure before he would trust himself to undergo it.
Well, I think that it was Bradley Whitford that kind of came up with the process. Because the grandpa was the one who raced against... Oh, no, he wasn't. He was the great-grandfather that raced up against Jesse Owens.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought that was the guy who raced against Jesse Owens. Now that it's the case, then he's an athlete, not a scientist. But anyway, so how do we... The buildup of this, another aspect that I kind of really had a problem with, the fact that they were so lazy to remove the charger from the phone. Why not just take the phone or the charger or both?
Well, you could possibly make him think, oh, did I forget to plug it in?
But that's the thing,
yeah.
though. It's like if they're concerned about him calling the outside world or having connections outside to the outside world... Why not just remove that completely?
Or set up a cell phone jammer and just tell them, hey, you're too far away, there's no coverage.
And that's true. But what about you, Chris? Is any of this kind of... do you have anything to add to this? Any retorts?
I mean, I didn't really think about that with the cell phone, I guess. I mean, I guess I was just thinking they were trying to make it look like he thought he plugged it in but forgot to, you know, or some shit. Just kind of like, I don't know. You're out of it in the morning and you don't plug it in. You thought you did. Some bullshit.
Yeah.
But then his phone is still dead, but it's still sitting there where he left it. So he doesn't suspect foul play, maybe.
And then why doesn't he take his cell phone? I mean, after the first time, just charge it and keep it with you. I mean, at that particular... The thing is the cell phone in itself, to me, just feels like a... Like a really boneheaded move. You know, if Chris, after the first time that it's going uncharged, and he thinks that someone else is doing it, because he automatically suspects Georgina, right? He immediately suspects her. And what does he do? I mean, he basically keeps doing it. He keeps leaving it out. I mean, seriously, if this is going to be the case, charge it, keep it on you. Make sure that that you're around when it charges, and then as soon as it's done charging, you just keep it. I mean, I don't know. To me, it just seems really stupid that it took, three times? At least two, but three times maybe that this happens? And he doesn't think to just keep his phone on him?
Well, if it's about to die, what good is it keeping on him, you know?
Well, after you charge it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, he says it's dead. He's, sitting there pressing it, that it's dead. And then the next scene, he's fucking using it.
Well, that's because he sticks around and waits for it to charge, which is what he should be doing to begin with. But then he decides, you know what? Okay, it's done charging. I'm just going to leave it right there on the charger. And so when he comes back and it's unplugged, oh my goodness, how did it get unplugged? That's bullshit.
It was mice. Yes, it was mice in the house.
But was it really Georgina that was doing it? Because I think, if I'm not correct, I think it was actually...
could be Rose.
I think it was Rose.
Yeah.
Rose was the one that was actually in charging it, but he automatically assumed it was Georgina because Georgina was acting weird, and maybe because, in a way, he also mistrusts African-Americans.
Well, she also comes in and kind of confesses. So
No, that was afterwards.
Oh, that's
after
later?
He complains to Rose.
Okay.
And Rose goes off, and then all of a sudden, Georgina comes back, and then she apologizes. Or semi-apologizes, right? But let's also talk about the party.
Weird.
Now,
so.
Well, this is under the guise that this party happens once a year to celebrate the grandfather.
Allegedly.
And, allegedly.
Yeah.
The thing is that really, really the case? Or is the party basically just a ruse to have the auction?
It's a ruse. It's clear, once we start the auction, it's obviously a ruse. It's the party's now? Oh, you're so lucky you're here for the party. Sure,
Well, what about you, Chris? Do you think that this was an actual party or just a ruse?
Probably a ruse, I guess. But, I mean, I was going to say, given... If you're going by the time frame, then it would have to be, right? Because they're trying to make it an annual party, right?
Yeah.
But if they're doing it every few months, then...
Yeah, I'd say a 4 to 5 month stretch to us.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Here's my next question. This happens after the initial brainwashing that occurs, right? If they're concerned... basically they knew they have him locked, that they're going to sell his body off. Which I don't think I have to tell you kind of what it sounds like, especially when you have people checking out his arms, checking out his golf swing.
Asking about health, asking all sorts of weird personal little things. So,
yes. Which I don't know, it kind of reminded me of the auction scene in 12 Years a Slave or the auction house.
Can I just say the absolute disgusting, bad thing here and say, nobody checks his dong? Really? I'm going to transfer my mind to that person.
She asked about it.
Oh, who did?
Is it actually, is what they say, is it actually better?
Yeah, okay. I figured we'd give Rose to dictate on that one. Say, thumbs up. Yeah.
Dictate.
Well, she kind of does.
Yeah.
But all the same, though, here's my question, though. If they pretty much know they have him locked... And he's not able to get away. Why not just subdue him and keep him subdued for the rest of this instead of allowing him to cause havoc during the auction period as well as after?
You mean just...
Why not just either tie him up or cage him or...
Chloroform him, drug him.
do something. Yeah. I mean, because at this particular point, it's over. You know, we're talking about starting the next day. They do the process. So why keep him on the string even longer? Why even give him the chance to run?
Because free range is better. I don't know.
Oh my, we're going from slavery to
he's
to slaughter.
He's
at this
well,
point.
In a way, they are now treating him as cattle. Get up for the bidding.
But to where?
And perhaps any they don't want to drug him because they don't know if what effect that could have. He may have to.
I'm talking about
be,
drugging. I'm talking about just tying up, caging up.
Or why not just keep him in the sunken place the whole time?
That could also affect
that
it.
Too.
Yeah. So.
Unless he can't stay in the sunken place for too long without some sort of damage.
Well, I'm thinking that that there would be kind of a psychological ramification to that. But I mean, considering that they really need to be on edge and they need to keep him. I mean, if he's not supposed to be at ease, but instead at his heightened state of tension, putting him in a cage would probably do that, especially if he's under constant watch. You know, that would keep him under a torturous state, ready and primed for manipulation, if that's the way that the film is going for. If they're trying to say that he is supposed to be in a relaxed state, the way that they're treating him at the auction house and the way that they constantly put him on edge is definitely not keeping him in a calm state. It feels like they're keeping him out there so that he can ask more questions and so that we can get more information without becoming overt. It doesn't make sense in the long run why they keep doing this. And especially considering that this is not their first time, that they've done it at least 8 times before, then they should have this down to an art form, right? This should be well oiled. They've done this before. They've done this enough times that it should be pretty. They should know where every step of the way is going to go, right?
That could be part of the reason. So we also don't know if any of these have failed, and maybe that's the only time it did fail was when they did try something like that.
But that's the thing, though. We don't know. Yeah. As to the we have to believe that they've been successful 8 times. The film makes it at least pretty clear that this is a pretty successful thing that's happening. So we cannot believe that any time that it's failed, or otherwise they should have made it clear that there have been failures. Which also leads me to my other question regarding the fact that we only see 3 of the 8. What happened to those other 5? They could have been failures. We could assume that they're failures, maybe. But
or there's no reason for them to be there.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, is that this is leading us to wonder exactly what the real deal is. Because, I mean, if there are 8 people that this has happened to, we only see 3, then there's 5 that we don't have any account for. We don't know if they're dead. We don't know if they're alive. We're having to assume their fates. For all we know, they were actually able to get away. We don't know, right? So what happened to those 5?
I think they got replaced, and there's just no reason for them to be there anymore. Because you have Grandma and Grandpa, who are still there, stay near the family. Don't know why the most recent one, that we could tell, would be there, except for maybe just to show off. Everybody else is, like, known. I mean, it's like, everybody else who's there is bidding on a guy. So, now, if she had brought back, done some sort of group thing, and brought a man and a woman back, and said, hey, we're in this poly relationship, then, I could see couples going, yeah, we want them both. But...
Uh-huh. And understand, he's supposedly off on a walk with Rose. At any point, he could have just walked right in on the auction and saw what they were doing. Especially with that big-ass picture of him out in the front and them waving around Bingo as auction markers.
Well, I think Rose is guiding the walk away from it, and they're being quiet.
Well, but at any point, he could say, screw this, I'm going back. I'm going to grab my stuff and go. All he has to do is just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and this whole thing is over.
They could hide the portrait real quick and then go back to pretending they're playing Bingo.
I doubt it. Not the way that those pictures, not the way that they're lined up in rows like that.
White people play Bingo weird. that could just be his view. It's like, you guys are weird. What does he know of the ways of Bingo? Plus, all those cards were weird anyway. They were all already set up as bingos, and it's...
Well, no, what it was is that there were markers to indicate which, you know, which one is bidding which.
Right.
The whole idea was that he was going from 1 to 10. I'm assuming it's either in the tens or hundreds of thousands. Doubt in millions.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone's buying 10 million. But, you know, but they kept their markers up until it went too high for them, then they would drop it.
Mm.
And then, of course, Stephen Root is the one who comes out on top. Now, I have to admit, Stephen Root... I have a love-hate relationship with Stephen Root. I think we talked about it before on several other podcasts. But the thing is I want to believe that Stephen Root's the good guy, and then he always seems to turn out to be the bad guy. And that's no different here. Because when you see Stephen Root, right, and he's siding with Chris, he seems to have there's a bond between them because of their connection to photography. Actually, yep. There's more bond between Stephen Root and Chris than there is between Chris and Rose.
Yeah.
All right? That's
weird.
That's kind of a problem. That's a problem. But, you know, they share a moment where they're connecting over photography and art. We see that Chris has a kindness for this guy because of that bond, the fact that there's some genuine respect for him. And then, of course, we find out that he is the one who wins the bid and that he is wanting Chris for his eyes. And that he, even though he respects Chris as an artist, he's going to take him because of his eyes. And I'm almost thinking that he's also taking him because he wants to become him out there. He wants to be...
Take the person. He wants take to take the identity.
Chris Washington and make him the big thing.
Yeah.
He wants to take the fame and glory that this kid is
going
to grow
kind
into.
Kind of a Being John Malkovich thing going.
Oh, no, there's so much Being John Malkovich all over this bitch.
Yeah.
It should almost be a sequel. It should almost be a sequel. Oh, come on. Admit it, Chris. There is a lot of Being John Malkovich, not including Catherine Keener in this thing.
Oh, beat me to my own geek sheet, would ya? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Come on, you have to admit.
I mean, I can see the influence, yeah.
All right. Well, you see the influence of Being John Malkovich. You know what other thing I see an influence in? The Stepford Wives. All right, have y'all seen The Stepford Wives, out of curiosity?
I've never actually seen it. I only hear things about it where it's pretty much...
I feel like I have, but I couldn't...
There's been a few remakes.
I want to make it clear. So. I'm talking about the original Stepford Wives and the Ira Levin novel, not the god-awful remake by Frank Oz with Nicole Kidman.
Okay, then no.
Okay. Because, no, that thing was a travesty. An absolute travesty. A fun travesty, but still a travesty. No, the Stepford Wives basically is the same premise. That these couples will go to this neighborhood, the husbands will join a club, and the club basically helps him replace his wife with the perfect replica of her. One that doesn't argue, complain, fight back, basically is the perfect wife in all ways. And we're following it from the wife's perspective as she notices all these really perfect women being wives, and her and a couple of friends are slowly being turned into the Stepford Wives until we find out they're all robots. But, yeah, that's the thing. And that's kind of what this movie is going for. And the more I, you know, basically it's a combination of Being John Malkovich and the Stepford Wives. And so when I hear things like, this is a new and bold and original story, I wonder how many of these people have forgotten these movies.
Yeah.
And it's not like these are little-known movies. These are really big, classic movies that we're talking about. And I don't know if you remember, Kent, but I wasn't exactly passing the Being John Malkovich when we had that conversation, to the surprise of everyone, including myself. But still, though, I mean... Can we still call this original a new take?
I feel like people, like, the concepts are borrowed, and it's an homage to whatever Jordan Peele loves as a fucking horror fan. But at the same time, what people see in it and flock to it for is like the racial and social commentary it has, and that's what's going to make it original in people's eyes. They don't care that the concept is recycled and used however many fucking times. How many other movies out there are addressing racism and social commentary in this way?
A lot.
Name another
one. A lot of movies deal with racism. Maybe not in a horror way, but in a lot of ways, racism is dealt with quite a bit. In fact, it's one of the more predominant things that we see in film commentary, is how we deal with racism. And honestly, what I was kind of hoping for with Get Out, because this is something that Key and Peele did a lot of, which is not only to look at racial spectrum as, you know, as black on white, but also kind of how black perceives white and how black perceives black as well. That there's more to it than just white people bad, black people good. And I was kind of hoping to see Jordan Peele bring that aspect to this movie. That I was hoping that he would kind of, instead of just making it where you have a black victims, that you were able to kind of see a bit of the nuance that the race issue has. That there's more to it than just that. And that is sorely missing in this movie. And on top of that, the fact that basically you're just saying white people want to be black people. You're doing it right there. You're laughing.
That's the opposite. That's the opposite of that line from Chasing Amy.
Yeah.
That is the... Are you saying that black people just want to be white people? Well, isn't that true? It is that inverse of that.
But so, I mean, the thing is especially considering Jordan Peele... his understanding of comedy and horror comedy at that. This particular concept would have made for a better black comedy, for a better comedy with horror aspects instead of it being a horror with comedy aspects. Because with that, then you can go bombastic. You can make this absolutely batshit crazy lunacy, you know, and still have the same commentary, still have the same impact, but at least be able to kind of put it in a way that didn't seem so contrived and so forced. Yeah. This is a big problem with Get Out, and one that I think that the film doesn't really address. It just wants you to ignore. And a film shouldn't ignore this. A film should be able to be willing to accept the criticism of this kind of comment, and it's not happening. And the critics themselves have played into that. And that's something that I have a real problem with in regards to today's critics, is the fact that, especially when it comes to something that affirms their own biases, they won't challenge a film for not following through, fulfilling its own premise. And just kind of going along and saying, yeah, this is great, or no, this is not good, and not really challenging it, not willing to criticize the filmmaker and saying, hey, you didn't do this correctly. And this time it was so obvious that they were ignoring the problems. They didn't even address the problems that this film had. In their opinion, no, there was no problems with this film. And how many times was it this movie make the top 10 list of major critics?
Almost every time.
And that's a serious problem, and it's a problem that film critics are going to keep having, and there's a reason why there's a deep divide when it comes to critics and audiences, because they are willing to kind of ignore these types of things. And yet at the same time, though, they'll crap all over things that are really arbitrary. If we were having a conversation about Bright, I would be talking about that specifically. Yeah, the critics completely trashed Bright for reasons that I feel are just completely unacceptable. But here they see major problems they should be able to see major problems that are blatant and yet just completely ignored it. But do you kind of see where I'm coming from, Chris?
Kinda, but I mean, I feel like Jordan Peele didn't want to make a comedy, you know. He wanted to make a horror movie.
That's true, and he did. He made a horror movie. But the problem is that he made a horror movie on the premise of something that's ridiculous.
I guess looking at it, I guess I don't see the need to. I don't understand why you need psychosis and brain surgery, you know? Is it just to put the other person in there?
The brain? Yeah.
The whole point is that you put a white brain in a black body.
Part of the brain.
People want to be black people.
Yeah.
If you were to break it down into one sentence, what this movie is, it's white people want to be black people.
It's, because
if they have their brain, why does the Flash make them come back or whatever?
I think it's only part of the brain gets moved. Oh, it's grafted on top of it.
You couldn't really tell. It looked like they were removing everything back there and behind those big fucking cones and shit.
We don't exactly know what process they do with the brains. We do know that they remove the top of Stephen Root's head.
Yeah.
We see the brain underneath. We know that they're going to do something with that brain.
Yeah.
We just don't know what.
But we don't exactly know how because we don't see that. We never see the process be completed.
Which is fine.
Hmm. Basically, for all we know, they actually do use the portal from being John Malkovich, and they just throw both of them into that hole. We don't know.
Very possible. Not going to judge that. But.
Basically, the Flash is just a way of giving a flaw to the whole plan. It makes absolutely no sense. There's no reason for that to be the case, other than just because they need something in order to expose a flaw in the plan, and of course to help with the finale.
Oh, because I mean, I guess like a Flash would, to me, it would help with the hypnosis. But if they don't have their original brain, wouldn't they be like, you know, just fucking all brain dead and shit, you know, and
these just zombies.
Like going into a spasm, you know, and just. I mean, that's just me. I feel like I'm just nitpicking bullshit, but.
Oh, no. That's actually a serious problem here. But at the same time, though, the thing is that it's also just kind of cutting the surface. I mean, the whole plan itself will fail. This is not a sustainable plan because they have to. Their plan relies that they have African Americans, and they're going specifically for African Americans. Why? I don't know. That's literally what they say. I don't know. Like, why aren't you using white people? Why aren't you using, you know, Asian Americans? Why not other races? No, it has to be black people. I mean,
well, it sounds like it's because, and I mean, this is going to sound terrible, but I mean, the movie, like, because they run fast and have big dicks. That's the way it seems.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
White people prefer to be black. Again, what the movie's all about. White people want to be black, yet it's kind of a weird racism thing.
Yeah.
You know, that white people are so entitled, they are entitled to black people's bodies.
Yeah.
That's so weird.
But then wouldn't that mean that white people are becoming black people, that they would actually have to do... That, yeah, you get the muscles and the dick, maybe, if that's really the deal, and so I can tell you right now that it's not, but... but then you'd also have to deal... They'd have to deal with that police officer that we dealt with just a while back. You know, they would have to go through all the trials and tribulations. You know, do you see where this commentary falls apart? It doesn't really make sense. If you think really hard about it, it falls apart. And on top of that, the whole plan falls apart because it relies on these people not having people, you know, being sought out or, you know, them going missing. At some point, they're going to be found. At some point, you know, this whole thing's going to fall apart. And it does. I mean, literally, it really happens. I mean, it happens here. You know, Rod is on his way. Even if they had gotten the brain, even if they had gotten Stephen Root in that head before then, Rod would know that that is not Chris.
Well, if they suspected, they'd probably just kill him. Which, that generates the problem of, if he hasn't said he's been to the cops, then the cops might go, hey, wait a minute, we found the dead body of that wacko who came to us? Then it would be up.
Do you see what I'm saying? At some point, this thing falls apart. All falls apart.
They've got enough money they can move the operation. I mean, they're making...
I don't think so.
If they're making this much bucks every time they do it, that is at minimum $100,000, if that was the bid. Which it could have been way more.
Well, I mean, if he says 10, so
okay.
I would
10 million.
That would be if it's $100,000 at 10, that would be a million.
Yeah,
$1 million. Which I don't know any art dealer that would have that kind of money.
Yeah,
but you know, anyway. But But do you see where I'm coming from? And that gets us to our finale. That gets us to the exposition of the plan. How Chris kind of escapes from his bondage and is now having to fight his way out of this house, right? And I don't know. It's so rushed. The finale just seems like, okay, we got to this point. We just need to end this movie.
Well, it is an hour and 44 minutes, which is, I thought was a little long.
The thing is that it just rushes through it really quickly.
Well, maybe it's to give an idea of, you know, he has to get out of there fast. The weekend kind of dragged, and it built stuff up, and now he knows what's going on. Time to leave.
He missed his dog. He had to get a brisk escape to go and
see
his dog.
Yeah.
I will say that the revelation of Grandma and Grandpa was actually pretty. In fact, I say that was the best reveal. You know, when Rose, who is celebrating her victory with putting all her boyfriends and girlfriend on her wall, and drinking milk. Very subtle, are we? And then she hears screaming and she knows that's Grandma. I have to admit, that was actually a really awesome reveal. And then, of course, then you think to yourself, okay, if that's Grandma, then Walter's Grandpa?
Yeah.
And that's pretty awesome how they set that up. And then, of course, when Chris crashes the car and then Walter is on him, right? And then, of course, you know, we have a Deus Ex cell phone. You know, the flash into the eyes, and then, of course, you know, that takes care of Missy, or, I'm sorry, of Rose, right? And then, of course, at this particular point, I'll tell you what I had in mind after Missy was shot. You know, after Missy was shot, and I'm assuming she didn't die at the end, right?
Shot.
She eventually dies.
She is left for dead, which doesn't mean she's dead.
Yeah. But I'm thinking here is, you know that if the cops come and see all this, then Chris is going to be is going to jail for all these murders, you know?
Maybe.
And then, of course, you hear the police car.
Maybe, but then we also have that initial report that Rod gives that's like, something weird's up there. This
would be a local precinct that will be picking this up.
But they walk into
and
that.
Even then, he did go out there of his own volition. And let's be honest here, you see a whole family dead.
One is a suicide.
Whole family and help are dead. And I'm pretty sure that the neighborhood will be more than happy to put the blame on him as well.
Hey, that we see.
The only thing that would probably save him is Stephen Root's skull.
Yes. It's open, and also, well, I mean, Grandpa, quote-unquote, committed suicide. He is holding the rifle and blows his head off, and that's the weapon that kills Rose. So there's an out, too. The help went nuts.
Well, they could also say that they were working together.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, and let's go off of Jordan Peele's assumptions in regards to race. That'd probably be what they would have thought.
Yeah.
So just saying. Yeah. Just saying.
Well, he does go to jail in the alternate ending. So,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, really? I
didn't get a chance to watch that.
I didn't. See
he chokes out Rose. The cops come, arrest him. Rod visits him in prison, saying he's trying to work a way around getting him out. And Chris is just like, you know, I got him. I'm good. You know, and he gets up and walks away. And him going back to prison is the end of the movie.
Yep, I had a feeling that was the actual ending. And I could also see Jason going, are you kidding me? You give him a happy ending.
Yeah.
Happy ending.
And an opening.
Well, then, and an opening
for a sequel if somehow Rose survived.
No.
I know. You don't want a sequel.
It looks like she died like when the car pulled
it
off.
It does, but you know, that's a rule of horror.
True. True that.
But I will just say one thing. I love the fact that it ends with Rod. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You put more Rod in that movie. I'm there. I fucking love Rod. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if like half the scenes that were cut were just basically more Rod.
Did you watch the deleted scenes?
I did. I didn't own this movie.
Okay. I own the movie. All right.
Okay.
So yes, there's like 8 different takes of his line at the end of the movie. And
yes.
I guess, like, my favorite scene of the movie is actually deleted scene, is when Chris falls into the sunken place and sees the ghost of the skeleton deer.
Yeah, that was actually in the trailer.
Yeah, they mentioned that. Jordan Peele mentions that, and he said he ended up taking it out because he didn't like the way it looked or whatever. I thought it looked fucking awesome. But, yeah, I mean, that's in there. The best stuff is the Rod stuff because, like, all of his lines are great. So
I'm sorry, the TSA, we find
there's better
shit.
Ones. I mean, there's, like,
I love
really
that.
Ridiculous
I
ones.
I love that.
And it's amazing. So.
All right. So, I guess before we go into Geek Sheet, what other aspects of the film really surprised you? What are the things kind of stuck with you in regards to this film?
The score is fucking amazing. Like, I like it a lot. I liked it a lot, especially on this viewing. Just, like, it's really, it's weird, and I like weird, so, you know.
There's a lot of weird connections.
What about you,
there's a lot. Looking at the soundtrack, there's a lot of weird connections going in with what happens in the soundtrack relating to... It's like, there's somebody who's, was a composer on it that's real name matches the name of the family. And so, like, did you choose
really?
That just because? Then, yeah, one of the songs is by Childish Gambino. So, of course. Yeah.
Well, are you surprised that Childish Gambino would be somewhere on the soundtrack?
I'm more used to him as the actor, Donald Glover, than as
Well,
the
I have
artist.
A feeling we'll be talking more about him
later.
Moving forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's got a few big projects coming up.
Yep.
Alright. So, are we ready for Geek Sheet?
Oh, you are not ready for the Geek Sheet. Actually,
yes, I am. Hit me!
Yeah, did you know our star was in an episode of Doctor Who? I did not know that.
Oh, really?
He was in Planet of the Dead. Smaller part, but, you know, it's the one where they go to the dust planet that's already been eaten. It was one of the specials towards the end of Tenet's run. Mm-hmm. Let's see. All right, we have a returning champion in Catherine Keener from John Malkovich. Bradley Whitford of The West Wing, because that's somehow we're in a West Wing kick here at Shea Kent lately. So a lot of that going on, and I've noticed he's been showing up randomly in horror movies. Like Cabin in the Woods. He's just like there. Like, whoa, what the heck? Is this like, okay, this was interesting, but... So he's been in odd places. The brother, Caleb Landry Jones, was Banshee in X-Men First Class.
Mm-hmm.
Marcus Henderson has been is another returning champion from Django Unchained. So, Betty Gabriel was in Purge Election Year in Westworld and is in the Westworld TV series. I need to watch that. I still need to watch that. Somebody send me the DVDs. and Lakeith Sanford is another returning champion from Selma. And then we get into Stephen Root, who I also know from the West Wing. So we've got two West Wing alums in this movie somehow. And this is where I have to make a confession.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible confession. After, like, watching him in West Wing for, like, literally dozens of rewatches because somebody turns it on and just lets it run, and he's big in season 7 of it, it never occurred to me that he is, need my swing line. Give me my swing line. He took my red stapler. It never dawned on me that that's the same person for some reason. So that is my big Geek Sheet sin. For this time, and he's done.
I cannot believe that.
I did not realize that was him. Maybe it's because he's just aged so much since then. But and to get back to Geek Sheet, he's done tons of voice acting work for various
everything.
Animation. Yeah. So, but yeah, that's why I ask forgiveness for not recognizing him from Office Space after all these times. Now I can't watch West Wing with a straight face. So,
all right. So I'm going to throw in a few extra ones myself.
Yeah, go ahead.
Basically, I just wanted to bring up a couple of like the editor Toby Oliver and the editor Gregory Plotkin are instrumental in a lot of the Jason Blum productions, specifically Paranormal Activity, Happy Death Day, which came out just after this, and in my opinion, a vastly better movie. I know. I'm so going to get some hell for that. Honestly, a lot of this just basically came from the Jason Blum factory. People have worked with Blumhouse on lots of different productions. And Jordan Peele used them to great effect. I will definitely give him that. And we'll get into that when we get into the final talk. So are we ready to call it?
Well, I am.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics almost unanimously on Get Out? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Chris?
I mean, I see all the flaws in it, I guess. I mean, I understand them, but at the same time, I guess I'm more forgiving of them because most horror movies are far from perfect. And isn't this Jordan Peele's first directorial movie here?
Yes.
For feature film.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess I'm being a bit more forgiving. And it was probably like one of the most fun theatrical experiences I had this year. And when you see, you know, 100 to 200 movies in a theater, that's a pretty big deal every year. I mean, but it's a hard pass for me, even though it's basically Invasion of the Negro Snatchers. But, you know, I enjoyed it, you know, so it's a pass. It's a pass for me.
Okay.
Kent.
I am going to, you know, I was on the borderline of pass of it, but the more we talk about it, the more it seems derivative. It does end up being a maybe. It is more kind of the modern take on some of these concepts of Malkovich and Stepford, but very, very good first directorial debut, though. I do have to say that, but I don't know if it's worth the accolades we're getting for Best Picture. Now, also, I do, and this is where I've gotten into trouble before, I see it a little bit more as a thriller than a horror.
Yeah,
so maybe that's an issue I'm having. Definitely, though, the Golden Globes can, or whoever that was, who was that that's got him putting this up as a, has this as a comedy or something. It's like, yeah. No.
Yeah, they have it labeled as a comedy.
No. What a bunch of,
no, it was The Martian all over again.
Yeah. Like, So, it's definitely in, should be in one of the dramatic categories, but anyway, yeah, I'm maybe-ing it, and maybe I'm wrong here, but I'm that's what I'm putting, but I am saying good, very good performances by everybody. So
okay, all right. So when I initially saw it, it was it's kind of how I still feel right now. There's a lot of things I absolutely enjoy about this movie. I love the setup, the build up that we have in this film is exceptional. That sense of dread, that sense of foreboding, that sense of stranger in a strange land, in a place where you don't know if you're among friends or enemies, that is a great starting point for a thriller. The problem with the film is what the film is trying to go for. The payoff for this doesn't make any sense. And what's worse is that when you see it the second and third times, a lot of the details that you first enjoyed about it kind of fall apart, because you put in context of what the plan is, it doesn't work. It's destined to fail. And considering that this has been done several times before successfully, assumably, we should believe that there is no way that this could fail unless certain things happen. And that's the thing. It's like, this thing was destined to fail from the beginning, the way that it was set up. Production-wise, it's a great-looking film. The editing is really well done. Great sequences. The initial session between Chris and Catherine Keener was exceptionally edited. I loved how they did the whole hypnotization. I love this sequence with the sequence of the auction itself and how they edited that together. There are things I really enjoy about the film, but the problem is that the overall product is flawed. And I'm really disappointed by the critics who purposefully ignored those flaws, who purposefully tried to pass this movie on as something great and original without ever calling out the major flaws of the film. When you don't call out flaws to a filmmaker who has promise, as Jordan Peele does, and I will tell you right now, I will still go to see whatever Jordan Peele does next because I firmly believe that he is on the track to be a great filmmaker. But if critics do not call out the things they do wrong, they're not going to learn. They're not going to learn what not to do the next time. And that is the purpose of criticism. The main primary aspect of criticism is that you call out things that need to be fixed. And the critics failed Jordan Peele. They failed him on a fundamental level. And that I have a big problem with. That I have, that I'm angry about. Because the next project that he's going to do is going to be flawed because he's going to think that he didn't do anything wrong the last time. And he made major problems. He made major mistakes in this film. So the question is, do I agree with the critics? And in that sense, no, I do not agree with the critics. I still think that this is good. I think that this isn't a good movie, but it's a movie that has promise and that shows promise. But I'm going to have to fail it. And I don't like failing it because there are stuff I like. And I love Rod. I love Rod yeah. so much as a character. But one character a movie does not make. And in that sense, I have to look at it overall. And yeah, I'm sad. I don't like doing it. I don't like doing it, but I am going to have to fail this movie. But this will come to the end of 2017. And gentlemen, I am so thankful that we've gotten to see as many movies as we had this year. And I promise you we're going to be seeing a whole lot more in 2018 because we got a lineup that is going to kill. But first, we have to say goodbye to 2017 by doing our Art House Selects, and this will be a first time for Chris, so you're in for a wonderful wonderful time this time. And then it's January, and Kent, what do we have in January? What do we have to expect?
Well, nothing is... Our titles are not finalized yet, but we like to look at movies that, you know... We think the critics were wrong about it, kind of, mostly. Yeah, definitely. So,
well, these are the movies that the critics hate. But we think maybe, or at least one of us, thinks maybe it got a raw deal.
Yes.
So in January, as we've done for the last couple of years, we are going to be doing our Art House Rejects. And quite honestly, I cannot wait to talk about these movies, even if I'm probably going to be ranting and raving as hard as I did on a couple of them from last year.
Look up the epic smackdown between for Star Trek the Motion Picture, available in our back catalog.
that is true. As with everything else at arthouselegends.libsyn.com. And if you have anything you would like to talk about with any of about Get Out, especially my very unpopular opinion, you can definitely do so on Facebook, on our Facebook page, as well as on Twitter, at Arthouse Legends. Or if you want to send me a quiet death threat, you can do so at arthouselegends@gmail.com. I will be looking at all of them. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this wild 2017. This is the Movie Dude, Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And Fiend.